Okay. So. Case number two today is United States of America versus Cristobal Vargas. Campbell Villamontes.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. Stacey Campbell Villamontes on behalf of Appellant Cristobal Vargas. Your Honors, the reason we're here today is because the government's paid confidential source made a prejudicial statement in front of the jury that he was told not to make by the government. And when trial counsel moved for a mistrial, it was denied.
Did counsel also ask for a limiting instruction or to strike the statement or for some lesser remedy?
No, Your Honor. Counsel did not ask for a limiting instruction. This testimony was so prejudicial that the government had actually previously told C.S. Rojo not to make the statement. I'm unsure as to why trial counsel did not ask for a limiting instruction here. I can only guess that maybe he didn't want to bring undue or additional attention to the prejudicial statement.
Well, what should we make of the word possible in Rojo's statement about possible cocaine trafficking? Wasn't that a signal to the jury that the police had no hard evidence, just a suspicion, they were just investigating? In other words, how can we classify that as prior bad act testimony?
Your Honor, even the mention of possible still left the jury with the impression that cocaine trafficking was going on either at the muffler shop or that Mr. Vargas was potentially involved with the cocaine trafficking. This led the jury to potentially infer that Mr. Vargas had the propensity then to commit the crime with which he was charged.
Well, even if we agree that it was error, because it was clearly not supposed to be something he mentioned, wasn't the error really harmless because the offense required proof that the defendant acted with intent to possess cocaine, engaged in conduct which constituted a substantial step toward the commission of the offense, and the evidence, when you look at all the evidence, the recorded conversations, the testimony of the agents, all the testimony was overwhelming. So what's the harm?
Your Honor, I think there was two questions in there, and I'd like to answer each of them separately. The harm of the statement is that C.S. Rojo was the first substantive witness that the government put forth. So this statement about Mr. Vargas being involved in cocaine trafficking really created a tainted lens through which the jury viewed the remainder of C.S. Rojo's testimony and the entire remainder of the trial. So that was the harm, is that from the outset, they had this ability to take an improper inference that Mr. Vargas maybe understood the code words that were being interpreted by the paid confidential source, and that he had the intent and knowledge to be at the Walgreens to purchase drugs instead of there to purchase a truck, as was mentioned several times throughout the recorded conversations.
But let me follow up on that for a second. I think maybe where Judge Williams was going is, suppose, contrary to what happened here, suppose the district court had allowed Rojo to say, I dealt on one prior occasion with Mr. Vargas with cocaine trafficking, and so I thought I'd come back and see if he was interested in doing another deal. Wouldn't that perhaps show that he knows it's cocaine, that he does know what these words are when there's this little walkie-talkie conversation or something? In other words, I agree with you that the phrase possible cocaine trafficking could be understood to mean it's already happened in the past, and I think the government is stretching it when they say, oh, it just means, you know, maybe are you about to do it in the future? That seems to me kind of silly. But the evidence was very strong against Mr. Vargas, and I just wonder why Rule 404B necessarily would have been violated with an even more clear reference to a prior bad act.
Your Honor, unfortunately here, there was no Rule 404B analysis, and there was no prior involvement between C.S. Rojo and Mr. Vargas.
But it's essentially a 403-404 argument that you're making, that the phrase possible cocaine trafficking suggests that Mr. Vargas had done it in the past. And then it would be a prior bad act, and you'd have the 404B analysis, right?
Correct.
So why does it fail under that, though? Why wouldn't it show intent and knowledge of the business, if you will?
Your Honor, it may, hypothetically, if it does pass 404B, the testimony is much more prejudicial than it is probative. It doesn't pass 404B because there's no indication that it was close in time to this act. There's no indication that Mr. Vargas was actually involved with any cocaine trafficking. But on top of it was so prejudicial. And we know it was prejudicial because the government advised C.S. Rojo not to testify regarding that statement. And so, again, it did allow the jury to make several inferences with regards to Mr. Vargas's propensity to commit the crime charged. And going back to the question about isn't the evidence here overwhelming, it's not. We're not arguing the sufficiency of the evidence, but much of the government's case was based on poorly recorded conversations with a paid confidential source. Some of them were misdated or undated, five of them, so half of the calls. And there were interpretations of code words. So many inferences needed to be drawn from this evidence in order to convict Mr. Vargas of an attempt to possess drugs that didn't even exist. And many of these calls actually involved references to other people. Different gentlemen coming. There was actually a reference in the arrest video of a gentleman named Pepe that was coming and bringing a truck. So there is a necessity here for a mere presence jury instruction as well to not only temper the improper hearsay testimony of the confidential source Rojo, but in order to ensure that the jury does not impart knowledge and intent on behalf of Mr. Vargas merely because he was present at a muffler shop that may be involved in possible cocaine trafficking, or merely because he was present at a Walgreens, maybe to be purchasing a truck, while there was a drug deal going on, perhaps by the gentleman in the minivan that drove him to the Walgreens and C.S. Rojo, or a drug deal between C.S. Rojo Pepe and the gentleman in the minivan.
But, you know, I didn't see an actual objection to the translations, if you will, of the drug code. And if you accept that, it certainly seems like Mr. Vargas knew exactly what was being talked about.
Your Honor,
these are fairly common. I'm sorry to say, our court is probably a great expert in drug code itself. And these are fairly common shorthand words that drug dealers use.
And, Your Honor, that's the impression that the jury could walk away with, especially having heard that Mr. Vargas was involved with cocaine trafficking, that C.S. Rojo was the witness that provided the main testimony regarding the interpretations. And so it allowed the jury to infer that it's more likely that Mr. Vargas did understand these code words interpreted for them by the confidential source and the DEA agent because he was involved with the drug trafficking.
Why couldn't they also infer it because he shows up with a shoebox full of $45,000?
Yeah.
And that is for the jury.
Right.
I mean, how's that consistent with, you know, buying a used truck that needed to be rebuilt? That's an awful lot of money for a broken down old truck. And, you know, that he was there to buy a truck seems like a very thin defense. So what is difficult to see is the harm of excluding the statement, I was buying a truck, man. I'm going on to something else here. And how can the exclusion of this one sentence be harmful when he was allowed to make this argument to the jury through other evidence?
Your Honor, it was harmful because this evidence was not allowed to come out with the strength of Mr. Vargas's statement that he was there to buy a truck. His employer did testify that He regularly purchases trucks and cars to rebuild and resell. However, that's very different from a statement at the end of the arrest video that would naturally qualify and explain the entire remainder of the 10 recorded conversations in the arrest video.
Well, when you look at your, when you look at the conversation right before he brings the money, I'm trying to figure out how some of these phrases could relate to the truck. Why don't you come over here by the shop? Well, there's too much people, man. I mean, what difference would that make? I mean, it's just really hard to fathom that all this language that came in before relates to a truck thing. And I mean, can you point to any of these conversations that you say mean he's buying a truck?
There were conversations that were had, Your Honor.
No specific language that makes reference to the truck prior to him making that statement at the time he was arrested.
Yes, Your Honor. When Mr. Rojo first approached Mr. Vargas, he actually came in because he wanted his truck to be fixed.
No. I mean the day of the deal.
This video that you want the last 2.5 minutes of. Yeah.
There is no explicit language there, Your Honor, regarding purchasing of a truck, except for when C.S. Rojo is speaking with Pepe and tells Pepe to bring the truck around to park next to another truck. And Mr. Vargas is asking, is that the truck? You know, he may have brought the money to purchase two of the trucks, which is why he was bringing another person with him, both C.S. Rojo's truck and Pepe's truck. He may not have wanted them to come to the muffler shop because maybe he didn't want his side business to get involved with his job at the muffler shop. There are a myriad of different reasons, and those are all for the jury to decide.
But I have another issue, which is that it seems to me he wants this in for the truth, period. He wants the jury to believe he was buying a truck, not state of mind, not anything else.
Your Honor, his statement does explain his intent of being there, and that's necessary because we've got a vicious circle that started here. It started with C.S. Rojo's testimony that he is a possible cocaine dealer. Then it moves on to the fact that there was no admission of this exculpatory statement that he was there for a purpose other than to purchase drugs. And it's finished off with the exclusion of the mere presence jury instruction, which would help negate the prejudicial statement that he knew about drug dealing, that there was possible drug dealing going on, and that his mere presence at the muffler shop or at the Walgreens was the only reason that he should be convicted.
So on what basis should that statement have come in? Because it was being offered for the truth, right? So it's not a startling event. It's not his existing state of mind. That's not relevant. How would it come in?
It would come in as an excited utterance, Your Honor. The statement did happen immediately after the agents came in with their guns and were pulling Mr. Vargas out of the car. It happened contemporaneously with his arrest, and so it would come in as an excited utterance and to show his intent, not just for the truth of the matter asserted, but to show his state of mind and his intent at being at the Walgreens.
And see, part of the underlying theory behind a startling event is that someone would actually blurt out the truth. And then that would mean that any kind of arrest situation, when any defendant or potential defendant denied it or said, oh, I really wasn't here for drugs, that would come in. I mean, part of what goes behind that startling event is that there's a likelihood the person would be telling the truth, like in an accident, somebody's hit by a car and they make a quick statement, the likelihood is that statement is truthful. This is a very different situation when you're confronted with law enforcement.
Your Honor, we would say that this statement happened contemporaneously with his arrest. It was in response to a direct question from an officer. There is evidence, contestable evidence in the record, that Mr. Vargas could have been there to purchase a truck, and this trial was winnable. Unfortunately, the vicious circle that we discussed previously prevented this exculpatory statement from coming in, and the prejudicial statement was not tempered by the mere presence jury instruction. So we do ask that this court would reverse and remand based on these three issues. And I see that I've gotten very far into my rebuttal time.
I'll give you a minute more. So,
well, at this time, I would like to just conclude and reserve any additional time for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Lau.
Morning.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Raj Lad, and I represent the government. I'd like to start with the possible cocaine trafficking remark, and I think a little bit of background on how this issue came up would be helpful. Mr. Vargas was initially...
Before you do that, I just have one completely random factual question. Is this man's name really Estebean, not Esteban?
It is spelled that way in the DEA reports and throughout the record, so it, apparently it is.
Okay.
The misspelling came in very early.
I can understand the district court's decision not to grant a mistrial, but why not strike the statement or give the jury an instruction limiting the use of the statement? I mean, even the government directed the witness not to allude to the tip that started this whole investigation. Isn't that alone an admission that this was prejudicial?
Your Honor, I think there are two issues here. The first is a limiting instruction was not requested, and I think actually counsel for the appellant touched on that. That may have even been a strategic decision by trial counsel. We don't know why, but there was no request for a limiting instruction. The second is on this issue.
And then at the sidebar, the government didn't ask if the defendant wanted a limiting instruction, right?
No, that's correct. And I think what's important here is
this. Because sometimes that can make a better record for you.
Certainly it could have. Yeah. I think it could have made a better record had there been a limiting instruction. But this passing reference to the possibility of cocaine trafficking is very different than the evidence that the government chose not to introduce under a 404B theory, which would be the testimony of the cooperating source who initially...
Mr. Aki Williams, who clued
the government into Mr. Vargas as a potential cocaine target. And so I think that's significant because it shows the difference in importance and prejudice. One would be somebody getting up and saying, Mr. Vargas has previously engaged in cocaine trafficking. Now, that may very well have been admissible under 404B because Mr. Vargas' defense ultimately was, I wasn't trying to engage in a drug deal. I was trying to buy a truck, and Mr. Rojo must have just misunderstood what I was talking about. But this passing reference to a possible cocaine transaction, the most it really says is that the government had chosen to investigate Mr. Vargas for cocaine trafficking, which is frankly an unavoidable fact in this case, that Mr. Rojo was sent in to the muffler shop to try to strike up a conversation about cocaine trafficking. And what's remarkable is that Mr. Vargas bit immediately, saying, oh, what are these guys that are coming across the border? Are they green or white?
Well, but really, I mean, the government didn't need that phrase to pop out of Mr. Rojo's mouth. I mean, you could have begun the story quite rationally for the jury with, you know, we investigate things all the time. We sent Mr. Rojo in to see if there'd be any response.
That's correct, Your Honor. And actually, that is how the trial began. The first witness was Officer Looney, who was essentially the case agent. And that's precisely what he testified, is that we sent Mr. Rojo in, we instructed him to go in, and you know, that he would receive this push-to-talk communication that could potentially turn the conversation to drug trafficking. So just, you know, addressing the sort of vicious circle argument, that's how the case started. That's what the jury heard first. There was this passing remark which was not elicited by the government intentionally, but which I think ultimately had very little impact on the jury. It's never argued. There's never any claim by the government, for example, in closing argument, that you knew Mr. Vargas was trying to buy cocaine because he had possibly done it before. The argument was, you know,
that assistant U.S. attorney would have been fired.
But, Your Honor, the argument is that you know he wanted to engage in a cocaine transaction because he was recorded multiple times on the phone discussing cocaine trafficking, and I think that's important. And the code in this case, in addition to being common, it's fairly transparent because, for example, switch between words like tickets, guys, Gaharis, all in the same conversation in a way that just wouldn't be rational if it wasn't a coded conversation.
And speaking of conversations, on page 4 of the red brief, you state that the phone calls between Rojo and Vargas were consensually recorded. Surely you don't mean that Vargas consented to the recording.
That would be one party consent, Your Honor. Obviously, Mr. Rojo was consenting to the recording of the phone calls.
So this comes up quite, well, not often, but can come up in terms of witnesses that were instructed not to make reference to certain things in testimony, right?
That's correct.
And he was instructed by the prosecutor not to get into it.
That's correct.
Yeah. Another thing you might consider doing is having the judge instruct a witness when there is something the witness is not supposed to get into. I mean, you can just pull a sidebar, have the witness come up outside the presence of the jury. The court can also instruct them not to do it and also say, and if you think in response to an answer, you need to answer this way, please let the court know.
I think it's a very sensible suggestion, Your Honor.
As a trial judge, I did that, and it worked. And it wasn't a problem. I'm just throwing that out there as a possibility that you can use that technique.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And here what Judge Cannelli did is instructed the government to lead the witness through the rest of this mm-hmm. portion of the testimony to avoid any more problems, which is what happened, and there was never another reference to it. I just want to touch briefly on the videotape issue. It's just a statement out of court by the defendant saying falsely, I think the evidence shows, that he didn't do it. He was there to buy a truck. The proper way to put that in front of the jury would be for the defendant, he certainly doesn't have to, but he could take the stand and testify and subject himself to cross-examination. So I don't think...
You know, under the rule of completeness, this was only about another 2.5 minutes. This story of his comes in anyway. It seems to me just wrapping it up wouldn't have hurt the government at all and allows this whole thing to be put to one side. Don't you think the jury realizes that people are going to pop out with whatever story first comes into their head?
I think, Your Honor, the reason the rule of completeness doesn't apply here is because it's a separate conversation. It's essentially sort of an artificial grouping that just happens because the tape is still running. The conversation that was introduced was the conversation inside Mr. Rojo's car between Mr. Rojo and Mr. Vargas.
It's pretty seamless. You've got this DEA agent saying, sure looks like dope to me. Who's dope? Vargas, there's no dope. Dope or money, there's money, how much money, and all of a sudden I'm buying a truck. So that's not terribly separable.
But, Your Honor, just to be clear, the statements, the exchange with the DEA agent and Mr. Vargas, that didn't come in. All that was introduced was the interaction inside the car.
No, I know, but I'm just saying, I mean, just one point flows into the next. It's not like there was a temporal break, was there?
There's a brief temporal break in the amount of time it takes for Mr. Vargas to be removed from the car. It was actually the video was also shown to the jury, and so it ends with before Mr. Vargas is pulled out of the car by DA. In fact, that was a way to limit some of the prejudices by not showing him actually being arrested. So the interaction in the car takes place, that conversation ends, and that entire unit is what's presented to the jury. So it's very different than the situation, in some of the cases relied upon by defendant where, for example, a defendant's previous testimony is cut and paste with the, inculpatory portions admitted and the exculpatory portions excluded, where what was excluded is casts a different light on what was introduced.
Let me ask you about the mere presence instruction. What would the harm have been in giving that instruction? Mm-hmm. I mean, what was the problem with that?
Well, Your Honor, Judge Cannelli's concern, and I think this makes sense, is that because the only two people who were ever involved in this crime were the defendant and Mr. Rojo, that it would leave the erroneous impression that essentially the crime couldn't take place if it was just Mr. Vargas and Mr. Rojo who worked for the government working together.
You forgot about Pepe.
I think Pepe
Rojo
was...
had arranged for the black truck with Pepe to pull up. And, in that scenario, wouldn't the mere presence instruction have been relevant to exclude Vargas from a possible cocaine deal between these other people who are present? I mean, it's not just Vargas and Rojo. It's Vargas, Rojo, Pepe.
Your Honor,
where's
Pepe?
Alfie Williams?
Yeah,
is anybody in the
Williams
car?
I don't know where he is.
Williams is floating around in the edge of all this, too.
Williams was just a tipster at the beginning who said he had previously purchased cocaine from Mr. Vargas, and then he's never involved in the investigation. Pepe does not come up in any of the phone calls.
But he comes
up
in the
truck. He's at the crime. He's there.
At the crime. And I think the inference is that Pepe is there to... I mean, Pepe is obviously the code for the DA to come in and arrest, but Mr. Vargas' impression, I assume, would be that Pepe is the one who's actually transporting the drugs. What's significant is there weren't drugs being brought by somebody named Pepe, and then the government says, Mr. Vargas, you're on the hook because Pepe showed up with drugs. Mr. Vargas is the one who showed up with something to the deal, and what he showed up with was the $46,000 in cash.
Does he know this? I mean, they're here. No matter how you look at it, you've got three people there. Right? It's not just Rojo and Vargas. You've got Pepe, Rojo, and Vargas.
So did you tell the jury that Pepe was the DEA?
Your Honor, there was never any indication, any testimony about somebody named Pepe being actually there. The jury certainly knew there were never any drugs involved, that the entire thing was a setup.
But the truck didn't drive itself up, from the presumably.
I'm sorry?
The truck did not drive itself up. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I think
so. There's a human being at the wheel.
Right, who is a DA agent who's participating in the arrest.
But was the jury told that? That's what I'm trying to get at.
I believe so, Your Honor. I don't want to mischaracterize the record, but the jury heard about the DA, from agents involved in the arrest of Mr. Vargas at the scene who arrived in that vehicle that is never actually identified by Mr. Vargas or Mr. Rojo, but when there's a reference to a truck pulling up, one could infer that that's a reference to the vehicle with the DA agents. What is significant is that the instructions did include a mere association instruction, which I think is probably the more important instruction of this variety here. Mr. Rojo, obviously not actually involved in cocaine trafficking, but is presenting himself as somebody who is, and Mr. Vargas does willingly associate with him throughout these phone calls. So to the extent there was a risk that the jury would infer that simply by agreeing to interact with Mr. Rojo or meet with Mr. Rojo, who is somebody that Mr. Vargas had come to believe was involved in cocaine trafficking, the jury was instructed that that's not enough. In addition, the jury was instructed on all the elements of the offense. So even if a mere presence instruction could have been issued here, and I certainly don't think the facts support it, it wasn't necessary to properly charge the jury, so it doesn't amount to an error that would warrant reversal, even if it could have properly been given. Mr. Vargas was convicted based on his telephone conversations where he talks about cocaine trafficking and his affirmative action of showing up with $46,000 in a box to meet with the person he had been discussing cocaine trafficking with. He received a fair trial, and I would ask that this court affirm his conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Lau. Thank you. Ms. Campbell Villamontes. 1 minute. That is a beautiful name.
Your Honors, Mr. Vargas was not given a fair trial. The statement that was made was prejudicial, and we know it was prejudicial because the government told C.S. Rojo not to make it. This was essentially a bell that cannot be unrung. The rest of C.S. Rojo's testimony was tainted by this statement and the remainder of the trial. There was discussion about Aki Williams' statement, and that was not admitted into evidence. He was a tipster. That was an unsubstantiated tip that would not have passed muster under Rule 404B, and that's why it was not admitted, just like the prejudicial statement of possible cocaine trafficking would not have passed muster under Rule 404B, not to mention that it was much more prejudicial than it was probative. All the DEA had to say was that C.S. Rojo was directed to go to the muffler shop. There was no need for any mention of possible cocaine trafficking. Your Honor, the government describes the testimony as necessary to establish a foundation for the jury to understand Rojo's subsequent interactions with the defendant. In other words, this is inextricable intertwinement evidence that the court no longer permits under Gorman. The government should not be permitted to do indirectly what the court has forbidden it to do directly. There were other ways that the jury could have been instructed as to why the informant was going to the muffler shop. With regards to the recorded conversations, there was never a point in time where it was explicitly discussed that cocaine trafficking was happening. There was never an explicit conversation about cocaine. All of the code words were left to be interpreted by the paid informant and a DEA agent, and was left to the interpretation of the jury that now had this improper inference in their mind that Mr. Vargas had the propensity to commit the crime charged. With regards to the exculpatory statement that he was there to buy a truck, the mere presence jury instruction was necessary in addition to the mere association instruction. They're most often provided hand in hand. I see that my time's up. I apologize.
No, finish your thought.
Thank you. They're most often provided hand in hand, and it was very necessary here because the jury was never told that Pepe was a DEA agent or a code word that the DEA should come in at that point. In addition, there was another gentleman at the scene in a minivan. He drove Mr. Vargas to the scene, and $3,500 was found in a compartment in the minivan. For all the foregoing reasons, Your Honor, this court should reverse and remand for a new trial.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The case is going to be taken under advisement. You were appointed, Ms. Kimball Villamontes, and you have the deep thanks of the court, as does your terrific law firm, Hinshaw and Culbertson, for taking on this responsibility and doing just such a fine job for your client. Thank you. And thanks to the government, as always. All right.